I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound Archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia at the Kelly Writer's House in our third floor Garrett studio by Katie Price, who is an associate editor at the Electronic Poetry Center, an assistant editor at Jacket 2, and a project associate here at the Kelly Writer's House, who is coordinating a conference called Poetry Communities and the Individual Talent, whose work has appeared at Jacket 2 and elsewhere and soon in Canadian literature, and who is working on a book-length project on pataphysical practice. And by Kathy Eisenhower, who lives and works as a librarian in Washington, D.C., and who is the author of Language of the Dogheads, 2001, Clearing Without Reversal, 2008, and Wood with And, 2009, who translated the poems of Argentine poet Diana Bellesi, and who has co-curated the In Your Ear reading series for several years, some years, until a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that's about right.
And by Christopher Schmidt, who was born and raised in North Dakota, went to Yale, worked as a graphic designer at The New Yorker, and Nerve, who has published journalism in The Village Voice, The New York Observer, and whose poems and essays have appeared in Tin House, Court Green, Canadian Poetry, and elsewhere, and who is currently completing a project on 20th century poetry entitled, great title, Chris, Waste Matters. So, Chris, this is your first time to the Writer's House? Is that possible?
It's true.
And thus to Poem Talk.
Very excited to be here.
Terrific. And Kathy, we were just talking about how we need to have more of a Philly, D.C. convergence.
Yeah, definitely.
At the Writer's House, and you've been involved in the D.C. poetry scene for quite a while.
Yep, I have been.
And Katie, nice to see you back at the Writer's House, your second home.
Yeah, definitely.
So today we've convened to talk about a prose poem by Jennifer Moxley called The Atrophy of Private Life. It appears in Moxley's book called The Line, which is indeed a collection of short prose poems much like the one we'll discuss. The book was published in 2007 by the Post-Apollo Press of Sausalito. Our recording is a performance of this and other pieces from The Line made in November of 2004. So here now is Jennifer Moxley performing The Atrophy of Private Life.
The Atrophy of Private Life. In the heavy fashion magazines strewn here and there around the house, the photos of objects and people mouth the word money, but you, thinking that no one wants you anymore, mishear the message as meaning. Arousal follows. The lives of the rich are so fabulous. The destruction of the poetical lies heavily on their hands, as on the swollen notion that we are always watching. There is nothing behind the mask, nothing suffocating under its pressure, no human essence trying to get out. Awareness, always awareness. Don't you see how these elaborate masks are turning you into a zombie? The private life is not for the eye, but for the endless interior. It is trying to push all this crap aside and find the missing line. Nobody, least of all the future, cares about the outcome of this quest. It is easy to lose, through meddling or neglect, an entire aspect of existence. And sometimes, to cultivate a single new thought, you need not only silence, but an entirely new life.
Arousal Follows got a laugh from this audience. May I ask, from what does arousal follow? Is it the misperception of money for meaning? And what's arousing about that, if so, Chris?
That's a very good question. And to me, this is kind of the one line that still stumps me.
I went right for it, but in a good way.
Okay. For me, just because in the recording that we just listened to, because it directly followed meaning, I suddenly saw her leaping into, like, you know, Deleuze theory or something. And so to me, it was like kind of the way that, like, reading theory can be a turn on. I don't know. That's the thought that I had at that moment, as because
Fair
it
enough.
Followed meaning.
I think part of the arousal comes from, yes, I think you can read it as they're interested in meaning and this gets them aroused. They're curious as to what meaning, but also arousal as a kind of envy, right? That line is followed right by the lives of the rich are so fabulous.
Mm-hmm. Exclamation point.
Exactly. So you can imagine someone going into the house where there are these strewn magazines, seeing something that looks fabulous, saying, oh, there might be meaning in this. Their lives are so fabulous. Maybe this can be my life. And I think that's sort of where the arousal comes in.
And she follows that with the destruction of the poetical. Lives heavily on their hands. The rich, the fabulous rich are responsible for that. Is that a conventional sentiment? I mean, it goes on to do something else, but what do you make of that, Chris?
I do. I mean, I'm suspicious of the conventionality of that sentiment, and this in as
wondering
being a
it
kind
might
of,
be ironic.
Yeah, or, certainly. I mean, certainly.
She's not a didactic poet, right?
I think what's interesting about her is that there are strains of didacticism in her that she also wants us to read against the grain. So to me, that's what makes it interesting, is there's this kind of like very sincere didactic quality in her work, but at the same time, as she says, awareness, always awareness. I think for her, that's that moment where she's, I think her problem is that, I think in some ways she really does believe this sentiment that the destruction of the poetical, you know, rests,
right.
You know, the burden is on the rich and the problem of the spectacle taking us away from the private life. And yet at the same time, she's saying it in a poem that in some ways is, you know, is meant to be read by others. As much as she might refuse that notion, she's also tugged back into putting those thoughts down on paper.
A reviewer once wrote about Moxley in general that she unmasks American bounty as actual impoverishment. And that seems to be relevant to many of the prose poems in the line, but that comment itself doesn't do justice to the humor, to the sexiness, to the body awareness. That sounds a little too straightforwardly political, but does it make sense in the context of our poem, prose poem, The Atrophy of Private Life? She unmasks American bounty as actual impoverishment. Kathy?
I think so, and I think she may do the opposite also, that she sort of, I feel like there's a lot of that switching going on with meaning and money. In some ways, I feel like those could be the reverse. They're both kind of currency, and they could be, I think if it were flipped, I'm not sure it would matter that much. And I feel like what Chris was saying about some of her statements, and they're very declarative in this poem, are ironic and not ironic simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So the voice is multiple, but even each utterance feels multiple to me also.
The lives of the rich are so fabulous. The destruction of the poetical lies heavily on their hands, as on the swollen notion that we are always watching. There is nothing behind the mask, nothing suffocating under its pressure, no human essence trying to get out. Awareness, always awareness. Don't you see how these elaborate masks are turning you into a zombie?
Katie, let's talk about genre for a second. Ron Silliman wrote about Moxley at one point on his blog and said that as he read the line, our book, he kept thinking of Lydia Davis, Kafka, Borges, the super short stories with lots of aphorisms and some comic turns. So does that sound right? And what do we do with that if, in fact, these are? And he also threw in the prose poems of, or the prose poem-like poems of John Ashbery, I think, because there's a certain Ashberian quality to the way the aphorisms get torqued. Anyway, go do what you want with this observation about genre.
Of so many authors. I think he's right to point out a slight similarity, but I also think this is dramatically different. Even with the title of the whole collection, The Line, she's putting so much pressure on the line in each poem. And troubling that. And one of the things I love about the whole book, actually.
The book's called The Line.
Exactly.
So is it a self-reference? Is it a metapoetic phrase?
I think to some extent, but just like we're talking about with all of her lines, it's this and that. And I love that she puts this pressure on the line as a lifeline, a straight line, a line of thought, a line of poetry. Mm-hmm. And all of that is going on. And I think... I think that is not something so many of the other authors are interested in per se. So that seems to be a unique aspect of this book.
Kathy?
I agree with what you're saying. And I think that issue of the line being a boundary also, but you're mm-hmm. between the self, between waking and sleeping and the self and other and different parts of the self. But I found this book to be very, very dark.
And I agree.
Though the humor was dark as well. And I think partially it's because I am at a point in my life that's a very similar time to when Moxley wrote this. And a lot of the way I read the book was it's that line can be time, and that when you hit 40 and after, and I'm sure that this doesn't happen to everyone, but you start to shift the way that you look at past, present, and future. The future becomes something that is without you, and the most of your life is behind you, and you're starting to shift your perspective. And so I felt like a lot of this was this self-examination of how to constitute a self in that moment of transition for the body as well as the
so does this mind. So the phrase private life, how does that relate to what you're feeling about this?
Well, I think the atrophy, the idea of atrophy of private life, either that private life is atrophying or that it's becoming, I mean, this book is about isolation, I think, in a lot of ways, so that private life is becoming kind of emaciated. There's the sets of relations are very limited. This is it feels like an empty house that's kind of a mess strewn with fashion magazines. So I feel like there's this sense of isolation and desolation. And, you know, it is Orono where Stephen King comes from. So
very depressing.
Yeah.
But do you, I mean,
Chris?
I just want to, you know, raise a question as to, I think you're right. And I've been reading this against, I think it's called Fragments of a Broken Poetics that was published in the Chicago Review, I think last year, 2010. Which is a very similar prose fragmentary, but more polished, more lapidary, where she talks about coming to this impasse in her writing and in her life, mm-hmm. and seeing this being written at the same time. So I think there are those connections to be made. But at the same time, I'm not convinced that this is Moxley speaking, that this
right.
isn't, you know, an allegorical scene in some way.
If it's allegorical, actions. What's the larger scenario? What's the larger landscape? Is it a critique of Capital?
Well, I mean, I think that would be the obvious.
Not
obvious. No. Let me take that back.
Let me just quote her on Capital. Moxley yeah. says in an interview, she says, I like to remember that even the concept of capital, the commodity, is framed by Marx as a magical thing. Mm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps mm-hmm. what you were going to say.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in the mask in this poem and the way that it keeps shifting. And so, you know, I think of taking back to Marx or Marxian thought as the you know, the commodity masking real relationships between people, right? Mm-hmm. And so
right.
that's in one
the
way.
The private maybe, life is not for the eye, but mm-hmm. for the endless interior.
Mm-hmm. So that I think that is the kind of the leftist line that she's following. In
ah,
this poem.
Another sense of line.
Sure.
So we are back to didactic.
Well, yeah. But at the same time, I think she's playing with that, and that she's also concerned with and troubled by the notion of masking in poetry, right? So if we could think of her poetry as being perhaps more didactic than a Poetics of pure textual jouissance or something. But
more didactic than Borges.
More didactic than Borges. But at the same time, with this playful quality, but also suspicious maybe of a poetics of surface, of surface effects, right? That the mask might represent in some ways.
Katie, what were you going to say?
I mean, I think that's just it. She's suspicious of, the line is, the private life is not for the eye. She's suspicious mm-hmm. of something being almost too pleasurable and that pleasure becoming a mask. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about before, where a line can be so pleasurable and seem to say one thing, and then when you rethink it, it says the opposite.
So the rich are responsible for the destruction of the poetical. This is not ironic. Huh?
I think it's overblown, but I don't think it's disingenuous.
Let's go back to the line for a second. Charlie Altieri, who wrote an admiring piece, I think it was a review, said that her awkwardness with the line unit may stem from her fascination with other means of other means other than lineation, because mm-hmm. it's a prose poem. Mm-hmm. Her fascination with other means of providing the internal density we expect from major lyric poetry. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Is that?
I think in Moxley's lineated poetry, we do find that kind of syntactic surprise
yes.
and awkwardness more readily than maybe we find it in these prose poems in this book.
I think it's interesting that this, as you were saying, I mean, I don't think it's Moxley speaking either. Mm-hmm, but I find, especially the two first, I don't know if you want to call them verse paragraphs here. I was just looking at things like articles, and she uses all definite articles in the first two verse paragraphs, except for a zombie. And then in the last verse paragraph, it's all indefinite articles. Mm-hmm, and there's a mm-hmm, huge shift mm-hmm. in the tone of those. And I think part of it has to do with that declaration and the trying to pin things down, mm-hmm. but in a sort of multiply and simultaneously so mm-hmm. that by the end there's an argument, but you're mm-hmm. not necessarily mm-hmm. sure what it is.
and maybe I love that you pointed that out, like the definite article versus the indefinite article. And to me, that amplifies the sense of desperation.
It does.
At least in the first and second verse paragraph.
It does. Yeah. It does make it feel very desperate.
Yeah. She's desperately trying to pin something down, and she's maybe reaching too far when she says, like, there is nothing behind the mask, nothing suffocating under its pressure, no human essence trying to get out. For me, I mean, that to me, that's overplayed in an intentional way. And so if maybe what isn't here to indicate poetry, if it's not the syntactic richness, I wonder if it's like the richness of speech act or you know, rhetoric that at that moment, it's not so much that she's describing a situation as it's like this performative. Mm-hmm. And there's a sense of, you know, there's almost, it's like, you know, like this, an unreliable narrator there. Like she's saying there's nothing is suffocating under its pressure. No human essence is trying to get out as she is suffocating it.
Right. Know? Exactly.
So that kind of like play between the levels is for me, the exciting drama
it
of
is,
the poem.
And it has that, cause I think performance is important in this poem. I think it has that. And then I just kept thinking of Judith Butler too, that about performativity of not just of gender, but of any piece of the intersectional identity. And then how that plays into the first sentence, which I just kept thinking of these magazines and these photos.
You know, the ones
that
she
are,
means.
Yeah, exactly. And they're reproductions of performances of
femininity,
of
hysterical
reproductive
femininity. Right.
Performance. You know, it's like, it's this sort of endless loop of performance and reproduction.
So when we mouth the word money, which I have to do since we're doing audio only, but I would say, and you, which either is the Hemingway you of her or the speaker, or you, meaning someone else in the room, thought I mouthed meaning, so these heavy fashion magazines may mean money or they may mean meaning. I want to shift just a little, Katie. Someone suggested, or maybe many people suggested, that the line referred to poetic lineage. And I'm not so sure. I think, and I think Jennifer Moxley has said, no, that's not, I was not intending that. But I've noticed that a lot of people, she published when young, and she made a big splash, and she's a lot of admirers. And you know, where Jennifer Moxley fits, is she post-avant, is she, you know, really a Ray Armantrout descendant, is she coming from somewhere else? That there seems to be a sort of a 90s group trying to do something different. Moxley has said very agnostically, you know, I learned a lot from the language poets, I learned a lot from the resistance to it. She doesn't want to stand anywhere, but there's a lot of expectation that she will be positioned. I wonder if the move to prose poetry in a book called The Line is a way of getting out of the way of that train wreck about expectations about poetic lineage. Boy, that almost might be a rhetorical question, but I wonder what thoughts you have about her situation.
as with everything, it is and is not. I think we're right to sort of talk about, she's not interested in line breaks, right? This is not, it's a prose poem, but she's interested in the line, maybe not perhaps of poetic lineage as such, but the line of being in a present moment, having memories of poets past and poetic influences, and then having this anxiety about the future. So being in this place where you are in the present, but inevitably time or people, literary critics will try to put you in a line. And I think that's sort of the anxiety of the whole book, is worrying about this point in the line.
The private life is not for the eye, but for the endless interior. It is trying to push all this crap aside and find the missing line. Nobody, least of all the future, cares about the outcome of this quest. It is easy to lose, through meddling or neglect, an entire aspect of existence. And sometimes, to cultivate a single new thought, you need not only silence, but an entirely new life.
If it is, I think we referred to this before, I think Kathy brought it up, it's been called a seriously depressing book, quote unquote, by a reviewer. Insofar as that's true, what's depressing about it? Let's just say that again and make sure we understand. Kathy, what do you think? What's depressing about it?
Well, I think there's lots of what feel to me like attempts to make some kind of reconciliation with mortality. So there's that. And it feels incredibly lonely.
It does. Katie, your thought on it's a depressing book, if it's indeed that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think a lot of the book is about her, or not her, but the speaker trying to, just like Kathy said, build a new life. And sort of this idea that in order to build a new life, you have to completely eradicate your old one. You have to start anew, right? The last line of the poem that we were talking about before. And sometimes to cultivate a single new thought, you need not only silence, but an entirely new life. So I almost read it as a writer desiring to have a new thought, a new experience, and coming to the realization that in order to have a new experience, you have to abandon all that was before and become a new person, and sort of the trauma of that.
Else the elaborate mask turns you into a zombie.
Exactly.
And that's a pretty straightforward observation. Well, look, we could talk about this for a long time. Why don't I turn to each of you to throw some other idea out on the table that we haven't had a chance to say a final word. Chris, would you start with a final thought on this?
Sure. So for me, the problem, and maybe what's depressing about this book, but also I think interesting and productive, is that she's interested in turning away from the spectacle, from the public, from the audience. And I see this less in this book and more in Clampdown, but kind of a turn away from politics and from the ability to have political agency to a poetic interior that will be more lasting and that will extend beyond this moment, perhaps. But at the same time, she's racked or troubled by the failure of ability to disarticulate from the public spectacle, from the idea of audience. And then this, to me, is what brings us back to the fashion magazines, and that unclarity between money and message, is that the language that we hear from that spectacle, we cannot but affect the way that we think and react even within our private interior lives. And so there's a sense in which we can't escape that, and to escape it is failure, to retreat from it is failure, but then it's doubly a failure because it is still with us when we do retreat. So that, to me, is the problem or the depression about this poem.
Terrific. Thank you. Kathy, a final word?
I just wanted to mention that I found that Grace Jones recorded a song called Private Life, and she did a video. It was written by Chrissy Hynde, but then she did a video in 1980. And in it, she wears a mask of her own face. And it was apparently very popular. I don't remember that, but I was wondering.
I like that footnote.
If there was any.
We'll leave it out there, and we will get a correspondence from Jennifer Moxley, who will tell us whether she followed Grace in those years. Katie, a final word?
I actually want to end with Jennifer Moxley's own words, if that's all right. That's just this beautiful
Please.
Line. This is from elsewhere here. By closing your eyes, you have become a permeable environment, the taunting paradox of all that you know, just out of reach inside your own head.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of gathering paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. And you all look like you're ready to gather paradise. Katie Price, gather some paradise.
I've been working on this book a lot recently, but I just want to plug Craig Dworkin's Parse from A.T. Los Press. What he does is he parses a 19th century book called How to Parse, an attempt to apply this principles of scholarship to English grammar. And he parses the book according to its own idiosyncratic method of parsing so that it reads noun, subject, verb. You get the idea. But if you actually sit down with it for a few hours, I think you'll find some really exciting things.
That's great. And some bells should go off because I think that parse has been gathered as paradise before on Poem Talk. So that's
another one.
That's another affirmation. So I think Craig is getting wings every time that happens or something like that. Christopher Schmidt.
I would like to plug Paulo Javier's new book from Marsh Hawk Press, The Feeling is Actual. Paulo is the poet laureate of Queens, New York, the borough of New York. And there's a lot of lovely...
How long is the term of the poet laureate?
I think it's 3 years, actually.
I met the previous poet laureate.
Okay. So. Yeah. So I think Paulo has it for another
2 years. Do you aspire to be the poet laureate of Brooklyn?
I live in Manhattan.
I thought you lived in Brooklyn.
I used to live in Brooklyn. Yeah. Okay. But so I have a lot of competition.
You used to aspire.
Yeah, that's true.
Kathy, and you're in D.C. Is there a poet laureate of D.C. or is that the same as the poet laureate of the United States of America?
There is a poet laureate of D.C. And...
But that's not gathering. There's no gathering paradise there, I guess. But oh boy.
I would like to just mention that some students at the Corcoran College of Art and Design in DC, where many DC poets teach, including Doug Lang and Rod Smith now, and Casey Smith and some others, they started a magazine called Morpheme. And the first issue is out. And it has lots of DC poets in it, and not me, so I'm not plugging it for myself. And I think it's going to be really great because they have this great artistic background, too, to do the material. So I think it'll be nice. And they'll be taking submissions from others outside the area, I believe. So
sounds great. I guess I want to gather some paradise. I don't always gather paradise, but it strikes me that the DC poetry scene... is a scene that is worth being part of. And so I guess when I just want to say that there's some poetic paradise down there, down Route 95 from here, and that we should all get in our trains and cars and go.
We
and
should go right
can
now.
You got to go back. Can you rattle off a couple of bookstores or reading venues or series, just a couple so that people can Google them and...
Sure. There's if you go to dcpoetry.com, you can find out about all the readings happening.
And you can sign up for an email newsletter.
Exactly. And Bridge Street Books, which Rod Smith manages, he has a series there. There's a reading there tonight, actually, that I'm going to after I get back to DC. And Mel Nichols does Ruthless Grip, which is sort of a traveling show that goes to lots of different venues in the area. And... there's another one called Big Bear that has usually a musician, a fiction writer, a nonfiction writer, and a poet. So they have an interesting mix of people, too. So.
Sounds great. I mean, the obvious thing is that we should all, when we visit these cities for other reasons, taking our children to see the Capitol, we should all know about readings that are happening that night and go to them. Well, that's all the arousal and awareness we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks very much to my guests, Katie Price, Christopher Schmidt, and Kathy Eisenhower, and to Poem Talk's director and engineer, Max McKenna, and to our editor, as always, Steve McLaughlin. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.